To put it mildly, the Jussie Smollett story has been quite the roller coaster ride. What started off appearing to be a President Trump-inspired hate crime turned out to be a phony staged act which played with people's emotions and took Chicago police away from actual crimes in the city. There were a few of them in Chicago. While we were all shocked and angered as the truth became known, my next guest in his new book writes how the scam that Smollett perpetrated is nothing new. Plays into an effort that can tear our country apart that's being inflicted on America by those who at least say they want to unite us. His book is Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. He's a political science professor at Kentucky State University. Professor Wilford Riley, thanks for being here today, Professor.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Learn more about Kentucky State University at kysu.edu. Before we get into your book, only because you've been studying so many of the hate crimes that have happened, and Smollett's is not the first fake one, at what point did you start to doubt what Smollett was trying to sell?
Well, I doubted what Jussie Smollett in particular was saying from the beginning because his story was so ridiculous. I mean, and you can correct elements of this if I'm wrong, but as I remember it, what he said was that two white men wearing Donald Trump MAGA hats and wearing patriotic print ski masks who were carrying a noose, a knotted rope noose, and apparently a gallon bottle of bleach had attacked him at 2 a.m. in the morning in Chicago. Now, this is a city that went maybe 85% for Hillary Clinton. And these guys were screaming, this is MAGA country, Chicago is MAGA country, as they beat him. They apparently recognized him from Empire. They called him that Empire N-word. Obviously, Empire is, you know, a big show among hardcore Trump supporters. And, you know, they beat him for a bit. They let him go. He had the noose around his neck. He was still holding his Subway sandwich, and he went home. The story sounded insane from the beginning. I actually wrote a locally circulated editorial saying that there's very little chance this happened. So for me, in this particular case, I was skeptical from the very beginning, and I was surprised by how taboo it was to be skeptical. Jussie Smollett was doing appearances on Good Morning America and saying, you know, the thing that horrifies me the most about this is that people doubt my obviously true story. I think, like a lot of Americans, like virtually everyone that's ever been in a fight or watched a cop show, I assumed from the beginning that this was a narrative that was very likely to collapse.
And it's kind
unfortunately.
Of, yeah, and it was kind of interesting, too. A man who spends his time in front of a camera and couldn't figure out which way a camera on the street was pointing, either.
Well, you know, he was going to get cut from the show, so maybe he wasn't all that good of an actor.
this is true. Now, with your book, Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War, what Smollett did is, I mean, just in the Trump era alone has not been an uncommon act by many people, has it?
Well, no. To pitch the book in a sentence, what I find using modern research techniques is that many, probably most, of these very high-profile recent hate crime accusations have been fakes. And that goes beyond Jussie Smollett. I mean, Yasmin Saweed, who claims that Trump supporters brutally attacked her and tore her hijab. Air Force Academy, where a general came and spoke on the campus before it was discovered that this entire series of profane notes and racial scuffles had been set up by a black cadet. Eastern Michigan, the beautiful young black woman that claimed that white men literally urinated on her. Keehan College, Wisconsin Parkside, if you want to go back a little bit, Duke Lacrosse, the UVA rape, Tawana Brawley, Azalea Cooley. I mean, all of these cases were fakes. The book compiles a data set of something like 409, there's no reason to exaggerate, hate crime hoax incidents just over a period of a couple years. So, no, this is not something unusual. I probably would not have focused in this area if Jussie Smollett's case had been the first like this, but there have been a great many. So the book looks at why claims of racial hate in particular are unusually likely to be false.
Do these hate crimes have a common purpose, a common thread between them, or are there some variables? Do they all have the same goal in mind?
Well, I think what I see is a two-part process. So most hate hoaxers are, I really think, just people committing crimes. At least a large number of them are. I mean, you'll see something like Velvet Ultra Lounge, actually in Chicago, that was burned down by the club owner, who I believe was a gay man. And he did so in order to collect insurance money, which he did. But his claim was that the club had been burned down by homophobes. So he wrote anti-gay epithets throughout the building. And that kind of guaranteed that the adjuster's search process would be perhaps a little less brutal and thorough, and that was done for financial reasons. I mean, Jussie Smollett's actual motivation was that he thought his role was being reduced on the TV show Empire. And he also apparently didn't think he was making enough money. He was only making $65,000 a week. So he staged this action to make himself more of a sympathetic figure. So that's one level. But at the next level, this is the reason for the aggressive subtitle of the book, which I think is justified. There's an entire infrastructure of organizations from left-wing media outlets. I mean, you're thinking about maybe MSNBC, Sean King, The Root, The Black Star, to the quote-unquote civil rights groups that grew out of the obviously legitimate 1960s social revolution, the Southern Poverty Law Center, but never left. All of these groups, when one of these false hate claims is made, if it reaches the national stage, tend to jump behind the person who claims to be a victim and support them. And I do think that there is an overarching political purpose there. There are a great many people from the heads of collegiate academic departments to vice presidents of diversity in corporate America who have a stake in the idea that America is still a very racist, conflict-ridden country. And I think that the secret behind this narrative is that that's not necessarily true anymore. There's very little interracial crime, if I can go on with this. I mean, sure. If you look at murder, 85% of white murder victims, 93%, which is amazing, of black murder victims are killed by someone of the same race. Person most likely to kill you is your ex-wife. When you do see interracial crime, and this is never spoken of, that's about 70% minority on white. So the idea that there's this epidemic of people attacking innocent members of quote-unquote oppressed groups isn't really true, but it's a very popular narrative that a lot of people have invested in. And I think that's why you see so many of these incidents.
Dr. Wilfred Riley, his new book coming out this coming week, Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. He is professor of political science at Kentucky State University. KYSU.edu is their website, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. You mentioned MSNBC. They actually had the nerve to bring out Al Sharpton to share his analysis of this whole story, which, you know, you want to be fair, bring out Stephen Bagonas, who was the one who was, through that scam with Tawana Raleigh, implicated of supposedly raping Tawana Raleigh and won a big chunk of Sharpton's money, along with the other two clowns that he worked with. I found that to be probably one of the more irritating elements of that whole story. Do these organizations, does the news media need this created hatred and racism in our country in order to, you know, without, it's almost like the organization that tries to bring awareness about the illness. Without the illness, they're not going to get money to do the work they're doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you actually said that a little better and more succinctly than I did. But yeah, I think that is what I'm saying. There are a very large number of people that have an investment interest in the idea that America has not changed dramatically since the 1960s. I mean, obviously, social programs ranging from affirmative action to minority set-asides to academic departments of post-colonial brother-man studies in colleges, all of those rest on the idea that there's a great deal of ethnic conflict in America. I, like I assume you do, hate an actual racist. But I think that the total number of members of the KKK, last I looked, was about 10,000. I mean, that's what most normal people mean by racism. So, and obviously, the United States desegregated in 1954, Civil Rights Act 1965, Affirmative Action 1967. So, yeah, there are a lot of institutions that have some financial stake, certainly some social stake, in the idea that the country is a racist wasteland, but we're probably not. And that's why so much evidence brought up to support the idea that we are turns out to be fake. And, I mean, I will say there's a bit of a double standard here. I mean, Al Sharpton, as you pointed out, was actively involved in the Tawana Brawley hoax. Al Sharpton himself has also been involved in actual racial incidents. I mean, during the Freddie's Fashion Mart case in, I believe, 1987, right, his National Action Network described a popular Jewish merchant as a white interloper. I mean, there were people outside the store with microphones, loudspeakers speaking against this business. Sharpton at one point said, if the Jews want to get it on with me, tell them to pin down their damn yarmulkes and come to my house. And as a result of all this conflict, back and forth fighting between blacks and Jews, Freddie's Fashion Mart was burned down. I mean, a crazy guy on Sharpton's team went to the store and set it on fire. So, yeah, I mean, I do think describing Sharpton as a, you know, promoter of racial peace is kind of crazy.
And you write about in your book, and you've certainly seen through university campuses, maybe even including your own, especially over recent years, all these programs, which are supposed to be the cures, affirmative action, various elements. I guess the umbrella term now is social justice is the catchphrase du jour. It seems like these programs, rather than curing, have been more divisive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think to some extent that's true. I mean, you can make a limited argument for affirmative action in some context. I mean, the USA in the 1960s might have been one of those contexts. But yeah, in general, a big problem is what happens when a cause is over, what happens to the organizations that fought for that cause or that goal? So, I mean, in the United States, at least in the South, we had legal segregation until the early 1950s. And this mass assembly of powerful organizations, I mean, the NAACP, the Urban League, the SPLC, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, Rainbow Coalition, was formed to fight these Klansmen, these segregationists, and beat them, and they did. But once the fight was over, the question becomes, what did these organizations do? Did they go away? And the answer is no. I mean, the SPLC's endowment, as Tucker Carlson and I recently discussed, is $432 million, and they're investing that well. So with the initial enemy kind of defeated, I do think the conversation has moved to these new, more fictional kinds of racism. Like you mentioned the term social justice, for example. But there are a bunch of these ideas. I mean, there's the idea of white privilege, which is that you receive major benefits in life just by being white. There's the idea of cultural appropriation, which is that if you are a white or a black guy and you like sushi, you're somehow stealing from Japanese culture. You know, all of this, subtle discrimination, institutional racism. My personal favorite is positive racism, which is the idea that some people treat minorities too well because they don't want to look racist. So you should be suspicious of white people that, for example, offer to buy you dinner or go out on a date with you. So after we as a country defeated first the Confederacy and then Southern segregationism, you've seen the organizations that led that fight not go away or, you know, keep a skeleton crew in case the Klan comes back, but instead move to totally redefining racism. And, yeah, I would argue that some of this stuff does more harm than good, most of it, actually. Like, there's a major lawsuit against affirmative action programs right now that's being brought by Asian Americans, if you've been following this. Because it turns out that the groups most affected negatively by affirmative action aren't kind of Anglo-American whites. It's two minority groups, Asian Americans and Jewish Americans, who post the highest scores annually on the SAT. So if you at Harvard say, for example, well, we're going to let in a mandatory 15% of black students, 12% of Hispanic students, 50% female students, you're going to be underrepresenting the group of Asian students that naturally would make up 25 or 30% of that university. So you're now seeing this whole complex racial tapestry of conflict and argument because we're no longer a black and white country. And, yeah, one solution to that problem might just be to treat everybody the same.
There's a novel concept. I'm going to do something now. I've waited for this point on purpose because I knew the direction and the information that Professor Riley was going to go. You are you not African-American?
By George, sir, I am. No, yeah, I think it'll be a little harder to call me a Nazi because I'm a black guy. Yeah, I mean, I'm not an extraordinary political right-winger either, although I do sometimes vote Republican. I would describe myself as a normal American. I'm a black guy. I have a PhD in politics. I teach at Kentucky State University, which in fact is a top 30 historically black college. So, and I will say, by the way, in an upper middle class black institution, although I hate segmenting myself like that, you see a lot less extreme political correctness than you do at a Berkeley or a Wesleyan or a lot of, I guess, historically white institutions, although it seems like a weird description. So I think a lot of the social justice movement is not hardworking Asian Americans or Jamaican immigrants. It's sort of these suburban white kids trying to be woke. And you almost now see the creation of these fake oppressed categories. So, I mean, there's a large-scale fat liberation movement. I mean, you know, Tess Halliday's or Association for Fat Acceptance, if I have the name correct, has something like 200,000 members. You see this redefinition of gender, where Facebook, last I looked, lists 46 genders.
Yes.
And they include things like ambiguous. One of the terms is demi-queer. One of them is android, which is my personal favorite. Like, I identify as a sex robot, possibly. But you're now seeing people who are ordinary, well-adjusted, upper-middle-class women from Cleveland trying to define themselves as in some way victimized. You know, I am fat, and I occasionally enjoy a bisexual experience. As a college girl, this makes me a member of a new victim category. So, yeah, I'm a black guy, and I think that the extent to which common sense ideas are shared by whites, blacks, Latinos, and Asians across the USA would surprise and please most people. I think the people that seem to be speaking for social justice are a cadre of sort of young white leftists. And the idea is that minorities are good because we often vote for left-wing political parties and we might help promote what are, in many cases, almost socialist ideas. I don't think there's any inherent love for black people on the part of, you know, Caucasian co-eds at Wesleyan or something like that. I think the idea is this intersectional coalition of the fringes is needed to take on, you know, the successful portion of the American population. And that's how you get weird alliances like recent Muslim immigrants and feminists, recent Muslim immigrants and gays, union workers and illegal immigrants. The idea is that all these people have to stand together against whatever the people with ties on or something.
Well, in this era of the post-Smollett situation where people are either gun-shy, slow to reverse, or unsure of what I can say, what I shouldn't say, what I can believe, what I shouldn't believe, I think Professor Riley's book, Hate Crime Hoax, Have Left Us Selling a Fake Race War, paints the realism that all these images others want to try to paint and confuse you. It'll be the counter to that because Dr. Riley writes with the facts, the reality, and the honesty, which unfortunately too many people are afraid to say, but it is there, and it is there to be learned from. Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. Dr. Riley is also a political science professor at Kentucky State University, kysu.edu. Professor Riley, thank you so much for writing a book that is going to teach many people, and thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.